You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SeavillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SeavillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes a Civil War and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, October 12, 2011, Rick Britton himself presented a lecture entitled Albemarle Boys in Pickett's Charge. Arguably the most famous attack in American history, Pickett's Charge, fought on July 3, 1863, and in the Battle of Gettysburg's third day, hurled 11,000 Southerners against a very strong federal defensive line. In the very center of the attack marched 400 men from Charlottesville and Albemarle. Here's Rick Britton.
I was born in Richmond, and I've always considered myself a Virginian, proud to be a Virginian. And so as a Virginian, of course, always been fascinated with Pickett's Charge. The entire division that was there, all three brigades, all 15 regiments, Virginia infantry regiments. There were two other brigades in Pickett's division that did not include Virginians, but they were left behind. I think one was outside of Richmond. Is that right, Ron? Corse's brigade and another brigade, then they're not Virginians, and they were left behind. They weren't taken to Gettysburg. So Pickett actually had the smallest division and, of course, arrived last, and that's how he got the honor of being the unit of direction, and we can talk about that a little bit later, for Pickett's Charge. If you remember, if you've read, did this go out on me? If you remember, if you've read Faulkner, and I've sort of read Faulkner, but found him really dense, so I'm going to paraphrase. There's a great passage about Pickett's Charge, and you'll pardon me, it's from the Southern point of view, but basically it says, in every Southern boy's heart, it's the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863. Pickett has yet to go in, and there's still a chance, of course, from the Southern point of view. It was the afternoon of the third day. Vicious fighting had already consumed the first 2 days of that hot July, and the fatalities still lay about as grim, blackened reminders of the horrible work at hand. As the artillery fire subsided, the Southern infantrymen prepared to advance. At the command, the serried ranks of gray and butternut formed quickly under battle flags of crimson and blue. They fixed bayonets. Over 10,000 Confederates were arrayed against the very center of the Federal line. A copse of woods and a low stone fence on an opposite ridge marked their goal. When they stepped off, a hush fell over the battlefield. Time froze. Somehow everyone, every single witness, realized it was a pivotal moment. It was a spectacle of war seldom to be seen again, played out on a grand scale across the vast rolling amphitheater of hills just southwest of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. When they advanced, the Confederate troops moved forward quietly, confidently, with their lines well-dressed. Then the Federal artillery opened up on them. Pickett's Charge at the Battle of Gettysburg on July 3rd, 1863, is arguably the most famous attack in American history. And if anybody can come up with one that's more famous, let me know. It's frequently referred to, in fact, as one of the turning points of the American Civil War, the high watermark of the Confederacy, so-called. On that day, Confederate Major General George Pickett's Virginia Division, supported by remnants of two other divisions, made a valiant attack across open fields against a very strong federal position on Cemetery Ridge. Albemarle County was well represented in this celebrated but failed assault. In Brigadier General Richard Brooke Garnett's brigade of Pickett's division, over 440 Confederates, and Ron Wilson, just brought in a brand new reference that said it was only 330. Over 440 Confederates, the vast majority from Charlottesville and Albemarle County, marched in lockstep across that valley of death as the 19th Virginia Infantry. This is their story. 19th Virginia Infantry Regiment was formed in May of 1861 at Manassas, Virginia. Of its 10 companies, one came from Nelson County, that was Company G, the Nelson Grays. One came, Amherst County supplied 2, H, the Southern Rights Guard, and I, the Amherst Rifles. The vast majority of the 19th, however, 7 companies, hailed from Charlottesville and Albemarle. They included Company C, Scottsville Guard, Company D, the Howardsville Grays, Company E, the Piedmont Guards, Company F, the Montgomery Guard, and Company K, the Blue Ridge Rifles. 2 of the 19th's companies, A and B, the Monticello Guard and Albemarle Rifles, respectively, came from the city of Charlottesville. These 2 had served briefly along with 2 other temporary student companies from the University of Virginia in a battalion that had helped capture the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in April of 1861. That short service made them veterans by the time of the regiment's organization. The men of the unit were predominantly farmers, although dozens of other trades were represented. They were also clerks, blacksmiths, lawyers, shoemakers, tanners, coopers, dentists, stonecutters, and wheelwrights. One 19th Virginia man listed his occupation as ambrotypist. Does anybody know what an ambrotypist was? A photographer. Yep, photographer. 4 simply called themselves, and this is what they wrote when they signed up, gentlemen, meaning they did not work. Didn't have to work. In the various companies, boyhood friends, fathers and sons, students and teachers fought side by side. They ranged in age from 15 to 62, and that 15-year-old, of course, was in the Army illegally. Their names are hauntingly familiar. In the regiment's ranks of the 19th Virginia Infantry marched carpenters, prophets, Garths, Omahundros, Hamners, Morrises, Shiflets, Sprouses, Norrises, Wingfields, Says, and Purleys. Those names sound a little bit familiar? Okay. Burkhead was a common name in the unit's Monticello Guard, Company A, as were Dudley and Brown. Lots of Dudleys still around. Company I carried 3 Higginbothams on its rolls at Gettysburg, as well as a 41-year-old tailor, and I've always marveled at this guy's name, John M. Funkhauser. I think I would change my last name if it was Funkhauser. Taken as a composite, the typical 19th Virginia infantryman was born in Albemarle County in 1836, worked as a farmer, and was 5 feet 8 inches tall with dark hair and blue eyes. He would be treated at least once for illness or gunshot wounds during his time in the ranks. At least once, the average guy. Thomas D. Durrett was a fairly typical member of the regiment. He enlisted in Company E at Culpeper Courthouse May 20th, 1861. He jotted down his age as 18 and his occupation as laborer. The roster describes him as being around 5 feet 9 inches tall with brown hair and hazel eyes. By Gettysburg 2 years later, Durrett had seen plenty of war. He had been captured in a skirmish near Yorktown in April of 1862 and had spent 4 months as a prisoner of war at Fort Delaware. He was exchanged in August and immediately returned to duty. At Gettysburg, Durrett marched in the ranks as a private. It's amazing to think of somebody would be captured, serve in a prisoner of war camp, and then go right back into the Army, into the ranks again, like he hadn't had enough already. Bennett Taylor joined the Montgomery Guard, Company F, on May 25th, 1861. At the time, he was a 24-year-old graduate of the University of Virginia and recorded his occupation as teacher. Taylor was the Montgomery Guard's first captain. At Gettysburg 2 years later, he was still serving in that capacity. Edward J. Herndon was a 24-year-old carpenter, also serving in the Montgomery Guard. Joining in June of 1861, he was elected to the rank of third corporal 1 year later. Edward, however, was something of a free spirit. He was reduced to private shortly thereafter for leaving his company without permission. You're not allowed to do that. He was reduced to... Herndon was in trouble twice more that very same year. He spent a month in the guardhouse in 1862, losing 4 months of pay. They docked his pay and was, you know, everybody's pay was docked because he hardly got paid in the Confederate Army anyway. And he was court-martialed in October of 1862. By Gettysburg, 9 months later, however, Herndon was back in the ranks as a fourth corporal. Leonidas Bower served in Company B, the Albemarle Rifles. He was 18 years of age when he signed up in May of 1861 in Charlottesville. As a peacetime occupation, he scribbled workman. Like many in the ranks, Bower suffered a bout of typhoid fever. For the last 2 months of 1861, Leonidas battled the fever and diarrhea in an army cot in the Charlottesville General Hospital. By Gettysburg, however, Bower was a senior veteran, with the rank of sergeant. When the war began, William Nathaniel Wood, known to his friends as Nat, and I'm going to be quoting Nat quite a lot, was a 21-year-old clerk in a Charlottesville dry goods store. From an Earliesville family with a roster of 11 children, Nat was a small man, listen to this, weighing only 127 pounds. With handsome features, including expressive blue eyes and an abundant growth of light hair matched by a fine set of whiskers. That's a direct quote, a fine set of whiskers. Nat was well-educated and well-read, though he had not attended college. He was also deeply religious. He and his immediate pards during the war were known as the Camp Meeting Mess because of their habit of holding worship each and every night. Nat enlisted in Company A, the Monticello Guard, on July 9th, 1861, but did not join the unit until the 19th of the month. At Charlottesville, a Charlottesville recruiter must have signed him up, leaving him on his own to get to the camp at Manassas. During the war, Nat rose steadily through the ranks. By July of 1863, he wore on his collar the single bar of a second lieutenant. At Gettysburg, Wood's immediate superior in Company A was Captain John Charles Cullen, who had enlisted in Charlottesville in April of 1861 at the age of 27. His war record reveals he was popular with his company mates. He was elected second lieutenant in July of 61, then jumped a notch to first lieutenant only 7 months later. On April 28, 1862, Cullen was elected captain. That role naturally kept him in positions of danger throughout his service to the Confederacy. Cullen received a gunshot wound in the thigh at Seven Pines. That must have been nasty. And was admitted to Charlottesville General Hospital shortly thereafter. Evidently, however, this wound was not serious enough to keep him out of action. By Gettysburg, he was back commanding his company, although perhaps moving a bit slower. The 19th Virginia had seen plenty of action before the Battle of Gettysburg. Although the fight at First Manassas had cost them but one fatality, only one they lost at First Manassas, the men always proudly recounted their participation in that Southern victory. The regiment first experienced real combat, first saw the elephant, as they used to say. That's what they used to say. I first saw the elephant at the Battle of Williamsburg on May 5th, 1862. Here the unit, under the command of General George E. Pickett, for the first time, unfortunately, captured approximately 200 Federals and 7 pieces of artillery. The price? Over 50 men killed, wounded, and missing. During the 7 days' battles near Richmond, the 19th Virginia helped break the seemingly invincible Federal line at Gaines' Mill. And we went there a few years ago. Did some of y'all come with us when we went down to Gaines' Mill? Nice battlefield, the way they've got it fixed up. In this action, General Pickett was wounded. This fight and a brief engagement at Frazier's Farm cost the 19th Virginia 20 killed, 115 wounded, and one missing. Rounding out the regiment's battle list for 1862 were 2nd Manassas, where the unit helped capture Henry Hill, South Mountain, a desperate rearguard action, and Sharpsburg, where the remaining 50 men defended a ridge to the south of town. 800, approximately, were at 1st Manassas. By the end, at Sharpsburg, and they lost men at Sharpsburg, there were only 50 with the colors. Early in 1863, the 19th Virginia, as part of Brigadier General Richard Garnett's brigade of Pickett's division, which also included the 8th, 18th, 28th and 56th Virginia Infantries, was detached from Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Separate duty in North Carolina and southeastern Virginia kept the 19th away from Lee's army until June of 1863. As Lee planned his second invasion of the North, he recalled all units on detached service. He needed every man for this invasion he could muster. On the 1st of June, therefore, the 19th Virginia now recruited back up to over 400 officers and men, but not according to the book that Ron brought in today, began its march northward. On the 7th, the regiment reached Culpeper, where it encamped for 1 week. During this stay, the Confederate government presented new battle flags to all 15 Virginia regiments of Pickett's division. These regiments included Garnett's 5, plus 5 each in the brigades under Brigadier Generals Lewis Armistead and James Kemper. During this special ceremony, the 19th Virginia stood in two ranks while the color guard trooped the new colors down the company lines. As the red and blue St. Andrew's Cross passed slowly along the regimental front, each man clenched it briefly, swore allegiance, and promised to faithfully follow it anywhere. Little did they know the price that promise would exact. Leaving Culpeper on the 14th, the regiment climbed over the Blue Ridge at Snicker's Gap on the 17th, and after wading the Shenandoah River the next day, rejoined Lieutenant General James Longstreet's corps near Berryville on the 20th. On June 25th, the 19th Virginia Infantry crossed the Potomac River near Williamsport. Riding at the head of the column was the regiment's commanding officer, Colonel Henry Gant from Scottsville. Orders were strict and rigidly enforced, wrote Nat Wood of the regiment's northward march across the narrow Maryland panhandle. There were but few stragglers, almost none. Public and private property was not molested except by due process of military law, and the men were orderly and polite, if you believe what Nat Wood wrote. Since when is any American army orderly and polite? Some are, of course, but not everybody. They crossed into Pennsylvania, crossing the Mason-Dixon line on June 26th, and entered Chambersburg the following day. For the next few days, the regiment remained near Chambersburg, helping Pickett's division destroy the local railroads to keep the men from roving the countryside, being polite and orderly, of course, if we're to believe Nat Wood. Any free time was filled with a strict schedule of 3 battalion drills a day. This must have absolutely driven the guys crazy. Here they are, technically in enemy territory, and what are they doing? They're drilling. On the morning of July 2nd, the regiment was force-marched toward the Pennsylvania crossroads of Gettysburg. As the 19th Virginia tramped through the July heat, word filtered down the ranks that the army had been engaged since the day before. They heard that Confederate Division Commander Henry Heth had started the scrap. Hustling the unit forward, Colonel Gant rode alongside the 19th's march column, urging his men to keep it closed up. Company captains echoed the command. Nearing Gettysburg, division leader Pickett sent word forward to Longstreet, his immediate superior, and Army Commander Lee, notifying them of his approach. "Tell Pickett, I'm glad he has come," was Lee's response, "and that I can always depend upon him and his men, but I shall not want him this evening." From Longstreet came a foreboding notice. "I will have work for you tomorrow." Pickett's division bivouacked that night about 3 miles west of the battlefield. When reveille came on July 3rd, the men of the 19th quickly prepared their meager breakfast. The usual jests and hilarity were indulged in, recalled Wood, and soon after, when ordered into line and we again took up the march, no gloomy forebodings hovered over our ranks. An hour's march brought the regiment to the western slopes of Seminary Ridge. Now, we got to be careful here because the names of these ridges sound really similar. So the Confederate line that I'm about to describe with the artillery is on Seminary Ridge. The hill they're attacking, of course, is Cemetery Ridge. Important differences. The 19th Virginia's third in command, Major Charles Payton from Stony Point in Albemarle County, later remembered that when the regiment reached this position, it was in high spirits and in good condition. Here the unit, along with the rest of Garnett's brigade, was formed into line of battle. So they're on the western slopes of Seminary Ridge. The 426 men of the 19th Virginia occupied the very center of the brigade. The 8th and 18th Virginia regiments formed to the right. The 28th and 56th came into line on the left. Totaling 1,900 officers and men, Garnett's brigade took up a frontage of about 600 yards. They were ordered to open ranks and lie down. Each regiment sent a small detail of skirmishers forward up the hill. It was approximately 8 a.m. So I see a lot of you looking on the map. So let's do a little bit of orientation on this map. This map has them already moving forward, but you can see the three brigades of Pickett's division pretty plainly. Garnett and Armistead to the top, and then Kemper on Garnett's right. Each one of those open boxes represents a Confederate regiment. And if you look at Garnett, you'll notice that his line comprises five regiments. So the 19th Virginia Infantry, the unit I'm describing here, is in the very center with the 8th and the 18th on its right, and the 28th and 56th to the left of it. But the 19th right smack dab in the middle, and you'll notice they're headed right for the angle. As the men in the ranks got comfortable on the ground, Second Lieutenant Nat Wood slipped away from his company and walked forward up the ridge. He wanted a better understanding of their situation. The top of the hill was a frenetic scene of martial activity. Artillery units came, it seemed to me, from every direction, he later wrote, and quickly prepared on or near the hilltop for action. So this is the top of Seminary Ridge. From horseback, the artillery commander on this section of the gun line, 23-year-old Major James Deering, was shouting orders while positioning his 17 cannon. Mounted officers alongside him anxiously scanned the federal positions on Cemetery Ridge. To these subordinates, Wood heard Deering exclaim, "That hill must fall." Deering's cannon, of course, were only a portion of the huge number of 12-pounder Napoleons, rifled guns, and howitzers that were unlimbering and setting their sights on the opposite ridge. Comprising over 135 pieces, the powerful southern artillery line stretched far off to the northwest and north. Just over 70% of the Confederate artillery was being concentrated for a massive hellfire and brimstone bombardment. That the hill must fall, Cemetery Ridge, that is, seemed a certainty to the young lieutenant as he scrambled back down to his men. The commotion atop Seminary Ridge, see, even gets me every now and then. The commotion atop Seminary Ridge must have convinced Lieutenant Wood that an attack was going forward that very morning. But it was not to be. The 19th Virginia lay in the hot July sun for the next 5 hours. Many of the men suffered from this extended exposure. Fortunately for the 19th, however, respite lay but a short distance to the rear. As the long morning wore on, canteen details ferried cool water to the regiment from nearby Spangler Springs. Suddenly at 1 p.m., two Confederate cannon were fired almost in unison, or as closely in unison as was possible. It was a prearranged signal. Then the entire southern gun line exploded into action, firing its iron hail towards the Federals on Cemetery Ridge. The Union pieces responded in kind, adding their mettle to the argument. Within moments, this fearsome battery and counter-battery fire escalated into the largest cannonade of the war. Historians would later claim that the sustained roar of this artillery combat on July 3, 1863, along with the 1883 explosion of the Indonesian island of Krakatoa, were the two loudest sounds heard on our planet during the 19th century. Think about that for a moment. To the men of the 19th, lying as they were behind the cannon, it was as if, and you can imagine, all hell broke loose. So these guns that are firing are just in front of them on this ridge, in front of them and above them. The earth seemed to leap from its foundation, penned Lieutenant Wood. The atmosphere seemed to quiver. Now the heat of the day was no longer important. The southern boys from Albemarle County hugged the ground and prayed for survival. Fortunately, the 19th Virginia suffered little from the enemy guns to its front. They were overshooting. Federal guns on Little Round Top, however, caught them in enfilade fire. These projectiles came in screaming from the right, ricocheting along the line. Major Payton recorded that the 19th Virginia lost about 20 killed and wounded from this fire from the right. One of these casualties in particular was a very serious loss to the regiment. Lieutenant Colonel John Thomas Ellis was a 36-year-old former merchant and commissioner of revenue from Amherst County. He had been with the 19th Virginia from the very beginning. Starting the war as captain of Company H, Ellis rose quickly to major, then lieutenant colonel. He had already been wounded once during the 7 days. As second in command to Colonel Gant, Ellis was lying just in front of the regiment in a small wash on the hillside. When one of the artillery rounds came bounding from the right, someone hollered, "Look out!" Ellis raised his head just in time to catch the solid shot directly in the face. His men carefully carried him to the rear under shade trees where he soon died. In Ellis, the regiment lost a good officer, a good man, and a polished gentleman, that according to Wood. It was but a small foreshadowing of what was to come. The cannonade lasted the better part of an hour. For the men in the ranks, it seemed an eternity. Then the artillery firing subsided and the command attention came down the ranks. The 19th Virginia rose quickly, closed ranks, and marched forward up the hill. They passed the battery line and were halted. Southern artillerymen, their faces blackened from working the guns, raised their caps and cheered as the 19th Virginia men passed through. "Here we formed a beautiful line of battle," remembered Wood, "and were in full view of the enemy." What a battle line. As Garnett's brigade was the unit of direction for the attack, the two other brigades of Pickett's division dressed their ranks once Garnett had formed. And this is a term that nobody uses anymore. Pickett's division was the division of direction. Do I have friends from North Carolina in the room? Okay, because the North Carolinians want to argue that it shouldn't be called Pickett's charge. It should be called Pettigrew's assault, Pettigrew being a North Carolinian. Pickett's division was the unit of direction. That means the other units attached to his for the attack waited for him to form first, and then once the attack was happening, they dressed on Pickett's division. In the division, Garnett's brigade was the unit of direction, meaning that Garnett's brigade formed first, and then the other two brigades of Pickett's division formed onto Garnett. Garnett was given the direction, and everybody else dressed on Garnett, following his movements. That's why it should be Pickett's charge. General Kemper placed his five regiments to Garnett's immediate right, while General Armistead, and it may be argued that his name was pronounced Umstead, but I'm going to pronounce it Armistead, aligned his men to Garnett's left rear. And you could see Armistead behind Garnett as they're moving forward. Pickett's division of 15 regiments representing 40 counties from the Old Dominion, the Flower of Virginia, it was called, steeled itself for the attack. Without a word from their officers, the Virginians expertly rearranged their accoutrements. Cartridge and cap boxes were unsnapped and examined. Canteens were shoved back out of the way. Canteens on the left side, cartridge box over here. You look at the contents, you open it up, you look in the contents. Cap box right here where this is hanging, you open it up, make sure you can reach everything inside, you get ready. The order to fix bayonets rippled down the line. With Garnett and Kemper's brigades out in front, Pickett's division covered about 1,200 yards of ground, just over two-thirds of a mile. That's the frontage of just those two brigades. Two supporting divisions under Major Generals Johnston Pettigrew and Isaac Trimble stretched the Confederate line far to the north, out of sight. Robert E. Lee was committing over 10,000 men to this grand assault. The Federals on Cemetery Ridge were awed by the colossal array. After a momentary hush, remember I said that time froze, everybody was just startled because this huge line of infantry comes up over Seminary Ridge and out into the open. After a momentary hush, a shout of, "Here comes the infantry," ran up and down the Federal line. Here they come. Brigadier General Garnett, one of the few officers mounted that day, cantered to the front and center of his brigade. Just out of an ambulance, against the orders of his doctor, Garnett was buttoned up to the chin in an old blue overcoat. "Forward march," came his command. "Forward, guide center, march," echoed Colonel Gant of the 19th Virginia Infantry. With their new colors 6 paces to the front, the 19th Virginia marched forward at the common time. "There was no excitement," recalled Wood, "no loud commands." Their goal on the opposing ridge was a small copse of trees and a low stone wall that bent back, forming an angle. And you can see the stone wall on my map bending back. The distance was approximately 3/4 of a mile. Behind that low wall and along a rude ditch that extended it to the south, crouched the northern soldiers of the 2nd Army Corps under Major General Winfield S. Hancock. Arguably some of the best men in the Army of the Potomac. As the southern line swept forward, the Union skirmishers that had been pestering the Confederate artillery rose up and hightailed it back to their main line. "Steady, boys, don't fire," were the cautionary orders. "Never mind the skirmish line, close up." With these words, the regimental file closers hustled any laggards back into alignment. Then the 19th Virginia Infantry continued forward as one, a 150-yard line of butternut, gray, and glistening steel. On the enemy ridge, Union artillerymen manhandled new pieces to bear on the advancing rebel infantry. They first came under artillery fire as they approached the Emmitsburg Pike, and you could see the Emmitsburg Pike. They have to cross it at an angle, a road that diagonally bisected their line of advance. Shells began bursting overhead, showering the regiment with deadly shards of iron. Shrieking solid shot plowed into their ranks, leaving gaping holes. The veterans quietly closed up and dressed center. The line got shorter. At the pike, they scrambled over two sturdy fences that framed the roadway. The act of climbing, unfortunately, exposed the men to a second line of enemy skirmishers. On the opposite side, they reformed their ranks in the midst of a small orchard. Once again came the order, "Forward, march." Here the 19th Virginia passed through the bottom, the Great Depression between the two armies, according to Wood, a swale between the two armies. The respite from enemy fire, however, was very brief. Quickly, they crossed the swale and found themselves 250 yards from the main enemy line. On the ridge, the Federal gunners called for canister. Now the 19th Virginia entered the defending artillery's most deadly killing zone. The widow-making rounds shivered the attacking infantry. "Down, down go the boys," wrote Lieutenant Wood. Here, Colonel Gant took a bullet in the mouth that knocked out virtually all his teeth. As he headed for the rear, the regiment pressed forward under Major Peyton. The brigade moved in good order, the major wrote a little bit later, keeping up its line almost perfectly. Within a few paces, the regiment encountered the advance line of the enemy. These skirmishers were lying concealed in the tall grass of the forward slope of Cemetery Ridge. As the Virginians neared, they rose up and delivered a startling volley at point-blank range. More Southerners slumped to the ground. The forward rank of the 19th staggered momentarily, then continued forward. The routed Union skirmishers, meanwhile, ran up the hill in confusion. "Here we captured some prisoners," reported Peyton, "which were ordered to the rear without a guard. The low stone fence and the main Union line was only 100 yards away." And I'll bet that none of those guys ended in captivity. They went to the rear probably a short distance, and then when they had an opportunity, ran back to the Union line. General Garnett ordered the brigade to press forward. The 19th Virginia obeyed promptly, loading and firing as it closed. With their skirmishers now out of the way, the Federal infantry at the fence blazed away at the men from Albemarle County. From 1 mile to the right, Northern rifled cannon raked their lines with more enfilade fire. Sometimes as many as 10 men fell from the explosion of a single shell. Under fire from two directions, their thin line shrouded by the thick black powder smoke, the men of the 19th Virginia leaned forward as if to steady themselves against a stiff gale. Then, with only 20 yards to go, the enemy fire became unbearable. Peyton remembered that the regiment recoiled under the terrific fire that poured into the ranks, both from their batteries and from their sheltered infantry. Lieutenant Wood was hit in the right leg. "Leaning against a rock," he wrote, "I ascertained it to be only a bruise." Corporal Ed Herndon went down with gunshot wounds in both the right lung and right arm. Lunging forward, the regiment gained the coveted stone fence. Here the fighting was hand-to-hand. Bayonets and sabers were used freely. Musket butts swung through the air, accompanied by loud demands for surrender. A few Northerners did surrender. The balance retired but a short distance into that copse of trees. As the Federals drew away, the 19th Virginia men knelt behind the lone wall and volleyed into them. They had gained their foe's defensive position, but real victory that day, required that they continue farther. The enemy's center must be pierced. At that critical moment, General Kemper's brigade came up on the right, and you see them up on the right there in the map. Armistead's brigade, having followed in Garnett's wake, merged with Garnett's lines and strengthened the Confederate position at the wall. Mere paces away, the Federal ranks were swelling as reinforcements rushed to the threatened point. And if you're coming with us, this pretty much is the moment that is depicted in that amazing cyclorama that we're going to see. It's this moment. There are Confederates at the wall, and Armistead in a moment is going to lead some of them over the wall into the Federal artillery. And you look around and you see all behind the Federal line, Federal regiments and units rushing forward to plug this hole, this temporary hole that's been created. General Garnett did not make it to the stone fence. He was last seen, according to Private James Clay of the 18th Virginia, astride his large black horse near the stone wall. Garnett was waving his hat in encouragement as his men closed with the enemy. Then the smoke of a thunderous Federal volley enveloped both horse and rider. His men quickly opened ranks as Garnett's riderless steed galloped to the rear with a huge gash in its right shoulder. Attempting to crack the enemy line, General Armistead mounted the stone fence and, waving his saber overhead while shouting, "Give them the cold steel," led a small band of perhaps 200 Confederates into the Federal artillery. Doubtless, some 19th Virginia men swarmed over the wall with Armistead, but their ranks were too thin. "I looked to my right and left and felt we were disgraced," wrote Wood. "Where were those who had started in the charge? With one single exception, I had witnessed no cowardice, and yet we had not a skirmish line." Major Peyton concurred. "Because of high casualties," he wrote, "our line was found too weak to rout the enemy." It was obvious that the attack was spent. From their tenuous position at the wall, the men of the 19th could see an overwhelming enemy counterattack brewing. In their immediate front, Union regiments were double-quicking to reinforce their broken line. To the right, beyond Kemper's men, an entire enemy brigade, and this is the Vermont Brigade, and you could see it on the map under Stannard, an entire enemy brigade was moving against their right flank and rear. The Virginians began to melt away. Lieutenant Wood quickly realized that remaining at the wall meant either death or a Yankee prison camp. Without a moment's hesitation, I turned my back to the fence and started across that nearly 3/4 of a mile over which we had so recently come, he wrote. As he hobbled his way back, he realized why so few men had been at the wall. The path of advance was liberally strewn with 19th Virginia dead and wounded. Wood was hit again as he made his escape. As the federal counterattack regained the stone fence, Private Benjamin Falls of the 19th Massachusetts reached over the wall to nab a Southern battle flag that appeared to be leaning, just leaning, against it. He grabbed the staff, but it would not budge. One of the 19th Virginia boys, lying on the other side, still held it fast. Falls jumped onto the wall and, threatening the rebel with his bayonet, yelled, let go of that or I'll run you through. Falls later won the Congressional Medal of Honor for capturing the flag of the 19th Virginia Infantry. What remained at the wall was a nightmare scene of carnage, a hell spot. The dead lay everywhere. The countless wounded howled in pain and cried out for water. At the wall, where in places the bodies were stacked several high, the still living underneath squirmed and screamed. One of the dead at the wall was Sergeant Bauer of the Albemarle Rifles. His war record simply reads, "Killed with the colors." Most of the men who had crossed the wall with Armistead were either killed, wounded, or captured. Probably the majority captured, of course. One of those captured was Captain Bennett Taylor. He'd been wounded in the side. As the survivors of the 19th Virginia Infantry made it back to Seminary Ridge, they were reorganized. It was greatly feared that the enemy would launch a counterthrust. Just over 270 men of the regiment fell in. The attack had cost them 156 casualties. 36%, and according to Ron's book, it's 46%, but according to the sources I use, 36% of the regiment had been swept away in about an hour. An hour. General Pickett passed among the men as they regrouped. To Lieutenant Wood, the division commander extended his right hand while almost sobbing out the words, "My brave men, my brave men." Thanks, Dunk. I did that on purpose. I'll explain it to you later. Almost 2 years of war remained for the 19th Virginia Infantry, but to the rank and file, nothing could ever compare with the horrific, gut-wrenching events of July 3rd, 1863. In their loss, the survivors of Pickett's charge were bound together for all eternity. Colonel Henry Gant's wounds kept him out of the war until March of the next year. After the war, he returned home to Southern Albemarle. He died in 1884 of the wounds he had sustained in Pickett's charge. After Gettysburg, Major Peyton was promoted to lieutenant colonel and commanded the regiment in Colonel Gant's absence. Peyton retired from the Army in October of 1864. He lived well into the 1920s. Isn't that amazing? Lieutenant Nat Wood was captured at Sailor's Creek in April of 1865. He returned to Charlottesville after the war and worked variously as a farmer, clerk, salesman, and bookkeeper. He also wrote, and I highly recommend this book, The Reminiscences of Big Eye, one of the best accounts of the war written by a man in the ranks. And, of course, he's buried at Maplewood Cemetery. Captain Cullen was wounded in Pickett's charge and spent 5 months in Charlottesville General Hospital, so the Army brought him back. He returned to the war and was wounded twice again. Cullen died in 1890. Thomas Durrett was also wounded in the attack. When the Confederate Army retreated, he was left behind in a field hospital where he was captured July 5th. He was paroled and returned to the 19th Virginia 2 months later. After the war, Durrett was captured once again at Farmville in April of 1865. After the war, he returned to Albemarle County. Herndon was taken to a federal field hospital at Gettysburg, where his right arm was amputated. He died 7 days later. Captain Bennett Taylor was treated at Chester Hospital, then spent almost 2 years as a prisoner of war at Johnson's Island, not one of the best places to go. After the war, Taylor worked for a few years as co-editor of the Charlottesville Chronicle here in town. He died in 1898 and was buried in Monticello Cemetery. General Garnett's body was never identified. No doubt someone, perhaps in a burial party, probably in a burial party, realized he was a general officer and stripped him of his insignia. He was probably buried in a mass grave alongside his men. Years later, the sword Garnett had carried into Pickett's Charge, a Model 1840 light artillery saber, turned up in a Baltimore pawn shop. General Pickett never really outgrew the pain and the humiliation of defeat suffered by he and his men on July 3, 1863. After the war, when former partisan leader John Singleton Mosby, one of my favorite guys, was on his way to visit Robert E. Lee at his Richmond home on Franklin Street, just down the way from the Virginia Capitol, he noticed in the darkness a figure pacing at Lee's front gate. So here comes Mosby, and there's somebody at the front gate pacing back and forth. Several times this figure stopped and reached out to open the gate. Each time, however, evidently plagued by second thoughts, he would hesitate, retract his hand, and begin to pace anew. Drawing near, Mosby immediately recognized the man as George E. Pickett. It took some convincing, but soon Mosby and Pickett were sitting in Lee's parlor, facing their revered former commander. As Mosby remembered, Lee's demeanor on this occasion was stiff and formal. His reception of George Pickett, icy cold. As they departed, Pickett growled to Mosby, "That old man had my division massacred at Gettysburg." "That might be true," replied Mosby, "but it made you immortal." Thanks.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.